Ecclesiastes, we are continuing. We actually have just two more shows today, and then we'll finish Ecclesiastes next week. And the last chapter is actually helpful, positive. I don't know if you've been reading through Ecclesiastes with us. A lot of times we avoid Ecclesiastes because, first, it's hard to say. And second, the theme seems a bit of a downer. The theme is the Hebrew word hevel, which is translated in our Bibles as meaningless. That's the theme of the whole book. Life is meaningless. You just have that and a cup of coffee in the morning and you're ready, right? Can't wait to start my meaningless job in my meaningless life today. Happy Monday. Well, that is sort of the writer's favorite word, but there is a reason that he uses it, and the way that he uses it is to help shift our perspective from a very superficial, temporal, worldly way of seeing life to a more eternal, spiritual, godly way of seeing life. And as we read through, we can see the things that he points out, and we go, yeah, I mean, if everyone would just see the world this way, it would be a better place, right? The idea that pursuing wealth as your primary goal is going to lead to fulfillment, he says that's hevel, it's meaningless. It looks like something's there, you're reaching for it, and there's actually nothing to hold on to. We're like, yeah, if everyone would just live that way, it'd be better. The idea that power, if I can have power over other people, the authority or the influence to kind of get people to do what I want them to do, that's when I'll feel comfortable and content with my life. Well, it's hevel, it's meaningless. And we're like, yeah, if everyone would just get on board with that, things would be better. But one of the important principles of Jesus following is we do not start by looking out at everyone else for the problems. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 7, Sermon on the Mount, before you go to take the speck out of your friend's eye, you should probably address the log in your own eye. And I think that image sticks with us, doesn't it? Can you imagine having a log sticking out of your face and you're trying to help someone with some sawdust on their and Jesus is like, just start with yourself. Start with yourself. And so if we apply that to Ecclesiastes, then all these things that we're reading about, these things that are meaningless, they're hevel, they're smoke, they're fog, we have to look inside first and say, is this happening in me? Am I a part of this? Am I a part of bringing this into the world? So we're going to do that with the concept of injustice to start with. And it would be in Ecclesiastes 8 and 9 today. So he's going to address injustice first. And I think that's something that we learn at an early age. One of the first complete sentences, you know, our children say is, that's not fair, right? We learn that early. That's not fair because we have this sense of what's fair and what's not. In fact, we named one of our sons Justice. His middle name is Justice. And it was prophetic because he has a very strong sense of, are we okay? He has a very strong sense of right and wrong. He like sees all the things that are wrong in the world and wants to fix it all, right? And I think a lot of us are like that. And when we see injustice, it's heartbreaking on one hand, and then it's like infuriating on the other because you hate to see somebody as a victim of injustice. I think about this when I watch baseball all the time. You guys know I love baseball. I'm kind of a purist. And one of the worst things that the baseball media has done for us is to put that strike zone on the screen. Because now we know. I mean, before the strike zone thing, we didn't know. We were like, I don't think that was really a strike. Now we know. I mean, and it's pretty clear most of the time. And so when they get it wrong, it's like, no, you can't, how can this be? Why don't we have automatic strike zone calling? Don't we have the technology? The answer is yes. And they're using it in the minor leagues. And so you're like, what? What are we doing here? Like, why are we letting players strike out on pitches that are balls and vice versa? And I'm getting some head shakes. Listen, baseball purists, I know it's hard, but it's the right thing to do. I hate seeing somebody with a Braves name on their jersey strike out on something that was a ball. It just breaks my heart. It's infuriating. Like, no, but there is something, and we always think, like, our perspective is when we see injustice in the world and in our home or in our school or wherever, we go, I think I could fix that. I think I know the solution. I think if they would put me in charge for a day, I could solve that problem. The truth is, we're not very good at that because we try to boil things down to something that's really simple. Like, you know, it's a right or wrong, it's a yes or no, when most of life doesn't really work that way. If you take just one of the darkest, you know, season in American history with the slavery, and we go, that was horrible and unjust. But we solved it, right? We solved it with emancipation. You know, you wrote this, the Emancipation Proclamation solved the problems of slavery, right? Nope, sure didn't. I mean, it seemed like the obvious thing. All we have to do is set people free and then, you know, everybody will be equal and it'll work out, right? Is that how it happened? Nope, that's not how it happened because everything is more complicated than we think on the surface. And so this idea of injustice, and we want to shift our perspective to an eternal and godly view of what justice really looks like in the world. We have to recognize that sometimes we are a part of bringing injustice into the world. Like, we're a part of it. And so we're going to look in the mirror. We're going to look at the log in our own eye first and then see if there's a way that we can make things better. So let's start with that. Ecclesiastes chapter 8. The writer is going to put injustice and joy together in this teaching. And you're kind of like, that's not possible. You can't do that. Well, take it up with God. Let's read. If you see something on the screen underlined, please read that aloud so I know you're awake and we'll enjoy this together. When the sentence for a crime is not quickly carried out, people's hearts are filled with schemes to do wrong. Although a wicked person who commits 100 crimes may live a long time, who are reverent before him. Yet because the wicked do not fear God, it will not go well with them, and their days will not lengthen like a shadow. There is something else meaningless, hevel, that occurs on earth. This too I say is meaningless, hevel. So I commend the enjoyment of life because there is nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany them in their toil all the days of their life God has given them under the sun. So the solution to our awareness of injustice is to eat, drink, and enjoy life. Is that on the surface what he's saying? It sounds like it. That sounds kind of like, just put your head in the sand, pretend like everything is fine, and do what makes you happy. Is that the message that we're supposed to get? I think one of the tendencies that the teacher is addressing here is our tendency to sort of get overwhelmed. Do you ever get overwhelmed when you watch the news? And you're like, oh, things are really bad over there. Wow, things are really bad over there. Wow, things are absolutely horrible over there. And then my neighbor's a jerk. And so you put all that together and you're like, I'm overwhelmed. Life is terrible. I can't solve all the problems. And we get this, it's called compassion fatigue. We want to fix everything. We want to right every wrong. And I think part of what the teacher is addressing is this mentality we can fall back on when we get overwhelmed and we kind of, you've heard the phrase, no good deed goes unpunished, right? Everything that we do to try to make something right seems to make things worse. And so we fall into this, well, if that's what I get for trying to help somebody, I guess I'll quit trying to help somebody because it only made things worse for them or for me. So we risk becoming bitter and disconnected and complacent, and we give up on honesty, humility, generosity, sacrifice. It's not because we don't care, it's because we do care, and it doesn't seem like there's anything we can do about it. Jesus simplifies this for us. He tells us, if you love me, you will obey. He doesn't say, if you love me, you will go and solve all of the problems in the world. Because that's just too much. I mean, we can't handle it. But if you love me, you will obey. And obeying Jesus is fairly simple. It's not really complicated. It's hard to do, but it's not like calculus. I mean, we can figure it out. It's just difficult to build our lives around that sometimes. But our job is not to solve all the problems. Our job is to first make sure that the problem isn't us. One of my favorite G.K. Chesterton lines. Someone wrote to him and said, you know, you're a Christian. Tell us what's really wrong with the world. What's the real problem with the, why is everything so bad? And his answer was, me. I'm what's wrong with the world. I see the good I want to do and I don't do it. So that's our response. We look inside, say, make sure I'm not part of the problem, and then we do what we can. We meet the needs that we can meet. And the teacher says there's simple joy in that, and just being able to go and do your job, or you know, interact with, take cookies to your unkind neighbor, or what the things that you can do that God smiles on. And when God smiles on what you're doing, there's peace and joy there. So we're not trying to be good so we get some kind of reward. We become more prosperous, or we become more powerful because of our good deeds, because we solve some injustice. The rewards that come from God through our obedience are things like you can lay your head on the pillow at night and sleep because you know that a good God is in control. You can wake up in the morning, even Monday morning, and feel joy because you get to be a part of what God is doing to bring goodness into the world. I mean, these are the rewards that come from this simple life of obedience. We're not to stick our heads in the sand and pretend like everything's okay. We also don't have to check out because everything is too bad and we can't fix it all. We trust that God is good and that he will bring justice. His justice is better than ours, and one day he's going to make everything right. So every injustice, as terrible as it is also temporary. God's going to solve it. Next, the teacher is going to talk about fate and chance. And I think this is tied into the conversation on injustice and joy, because it's tempting to look at some things in life that are unjust and go, well, that's just how things are. It's sort of destiny. It's fate. That's the way things always are going to be. Or to just go, well, that's just bad luck. So there's a little poem here, Ecclesiastes 9:11, that addresses this in a way I think we can relate to. I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Or favor to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. We go, yeah, that's real life. I mean, if you're the fastest, you should win. If you're the strongest, you should overcome. If you're the smartest, you should be rewarded, have provision for that. But we look around and we go, I'm the fastest and the smartest and the funniest, and no one seems to care. You know? I'm not the fastest in any crowd, but I think we feel this. We kind of go, like, yes, life is unfair. And then that line, but time and chance happen to all. Is that really what it is? Just bad luck? Or is it fate? So fate would be like something that's predetermined, something that we have no control over, that no one can change no matter what. And so these are acts of God. These are things that are ordained by God. We would call just destiny, human destiny. And that, so that's like death, right? Some of you want to add on taxes. Death and taxes. But death, for sure, like that's something that is the destiny of all humans, right? If you, unless Jesus returns before then, that's our destiny. But there are very few other things you can put in that category as just fate or predetermined. And so then we flip the coin and we go, the other side is just luck. Well, if it's not predetermined, then it's just chance. It's just a roll of the dice. And sometimes the dice roll in my favor and sometimes they don't. And I'm going to be mad when they don't. I'll be happy when they do. Is that what life boils down to? I think we're not actually very good at distinguishing between good luck and bad luck. Have you ever had something happen that you thought in the moment was bad luck, and it turned out later it was probably the best thing that could have happened? And vice versa. How many stories do we know of lottery winners? I mean, you talk about good luck, and yet their stories don't end well. I was trying out for baseball when I was a freshman in high school, trying out for the varsity team. And that weekend during tryouts, I broke my collarbone, fell off a bicycle and broke my collarbone. And I couldn't try out for baseball, so I was done with that. But I healed fast enough to play tennis. And I thought, tennis is for people who aren't good at baseball. But I thought, well, it's the only thing I can do. I can't throw, but I can swing a tennis racket. And so I played tennis, and I absolutely fell in love with it and played through high school, and I still play today. I would not still be playing baseball today had I not picked up tennis. And so did breaking my collarbone, was that bad luck? At the moment, it felt like the worst luck. But now I kind of go, I don't know. I love tennis, so maybe it was good luck. We're not even good at knowing what's good luck and what's bad luck. So these are terms we probably should just not throw around a lot, you know? Because we're not actually very good at figuring it out. Here's what we know. There's evil in the world, right? Bad things happen, and it doesn't really matter if you think of yourself as a good person or a bad person. Bad things happen. And good things happen, and it doesn't really matter if you think of yourself as a good person or a bad person. Good things happen. But there is a good God who is in control and is one day going to make all things new. Here's how Jesus says this to his disciples in John 16:33. He says, I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. Have you had trouble? Anybody? In life? Last year? This morning? Yeah. Jesus said, that's going to happen. You could be a righteous person, right with God, right with people, and trouble will find you. But what's his encouragement? I've already won. I'm the king, and I've already won, and you're in the kingdom. So guess what? You win too. Jesus wins, we all win. What's good for the kingdom is good for us. And so we don't have to figure out if our lives are being controlled by fate or luck or chance. We're in the kingdom of God, where he is in control. And if we live the life of a kingdom person, we call it Jesus-centered living here. If we live a Jesus-centered life, we're on the winning team. One day, all injustices will be made right. And we get to be a part of that, participate in it, and see it. I had the chance to go to the Hamilton County Chaplaincy Prayer Breakfast last week at the invitation of Scott Goff. My wife and I went and sat in this room with 250 people to just donate to and celebrate the chaplaincy program that works with the Sheriff's Department. It's an incredible program, a lot of people involved there. And their speaker that day was a lady named Jennifer. Jennifer got up and told one of the most tragic stories I've ever heard. A life of abuse, addiction, incarceration, broken relationships, crime, missed opportunities, alienating people, being alienated. But in jail, her most recent stint in jail, she only had one book she was given to read. It was a Bible. She began to read the Bible. Then she began to have questions about the Bible. And she would ask those questions to the chaplain and the volunteers that worked with the chaplain in the jail. And she ultimately realized that giving her life to Jesus was what she was made for. So she did that and was baptized in jail. When she was released, she began to work with a program that helps women who are caught up in addiction or drug abuse and help them find freedom, not only from that, but when the opportunities arise, she gets to share her story about how Jesus has changed her life. And she said in front of all of us, and I wrote it down because I couldn't hardly believe it, she said, I wouldn't change a thing about my past because it led me to what I'm doing now. I thought, that's crazy. Like all the abuse that you've suffered, all the broken relationships, you've seen friends die, all the rejection, the addiction, and enslavement to that, and you wouldn't change a thing? What she saw was that she had an opportunity in this moment of her life to do something that God smiles on, to be a part of setting people free. This is kingdom work. And she said, I never would have been involved in kingdom work if it hadn't been for all the things I suffered in my life. So it's worth it. I want to be like Jennifer. I want to get to a place in life where I can say, I wouldn't change a thing because it led me to this place where I get to participate in the work of God, whether it's through my job, through my neighborhood, through my school, through my family. I wouldn't change a thing. It's got nothing to do with good luck or bad luck for her. It had to do with getting on the winning team. When she becomes a part of the kingdom of God, Jesus is the king and he wins. So Jennifer wins because she's in his kingdom. The next section, the teacher is going to talk about wisdom and authority. It tells a little parable that I think is really helpful. So let's dive into Ecclesiastes 9:13. I also saw under the sun this example of wisdom that greatly impressed me. There was once a small city with only a few people in it, and a powerful king came against it, surrounded it, and built huge siege works against it. Now there lived in that city a man poor but wise, and he saved the city by his wisdom. So I said, wisdom is better than strength, but the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are no longer heeded. This is another place where we're reading and we're like, hey, you're kind of contradicting yourself, teacher. You're supposed to be really wise, but you said, wisdom is better than strength, but wise people are despised and rejected. So which is it? This story is really interesting because I think it has a parallel in another biblical story in 2 Kings chapter 7. Is this scene where the city of Jerusalem is being surrounded by an enemy army. They're under siege, and there's no food in the city. It's so bad. We find out later in the story there are only 5 horses left in the city. Where'd all the horses go? They ate them. There's nothing else to eat, okay? That's how bad it was. And so despair, obviously. Death is happening. It's just terrible. And there are these 4 lepers who are sort of... you know, they're outcasts from society, but they can't go out of the city or the enemy army will get them. And they get together and they're kind of like, how much worse can it get for us, right? We're already lepers. Our city is under siege. There's nothing to eat. We might as well go throw ourselves on the mercy of this opposing army. So they go out to where the army is camped and there's no one there. Like all the people are gone, but they left all their stuff, like food and horses. Delicious. And so they start like collecting all the stuff and they're like, hey, we're rich. And then one of them goes, hang on. We should probably share this with the people back in our city, don't you think? And they're like, yeah, we probably should. So they go back, they send this report to the king. Hey, the enemy army's gone and all their stuff is there for the taking. The king's like, no, it's a trick. It's a trick. If we go out there, they're just gonna come out of, you know, the hills and caves and get us. And then this servant in the king's household, not a nobleman, not a general, a servant in the king's household says, hey, shouldn't we at least check and see if it's true? Like, isn't it worth checking? He's like, well, I guess it's worth checking. So they send the only 5 horses out. Horses are like, yeah. And they go out to check and see if the, and it's true, the enemy army's gone and all the stuff is there and the city is saved. What's the servant's name? I don't know. What are the names of the lepers who brought back the good news? I don't know. Nobody knows. The city is saved by people who end up being completely unnoticed, unnamed, unrewarded. And you kind of go, that's life. You know, it happens. But what it raises for me is the question, where do I go for wisdom? Where do we go when we want answers? I don't mean just YouTube. A lot of answers there, but I mean people. Like, who do you look to? Who's the expert in your field? When you want to get better at what you do, where do you look for wisdom? Well, as a pastor, there it's really tempting to go and look to the big name pastors and say, hey, they've got huge churches. They must have it figured out. I should go to them for wisdom about how to get better at my job. I've just learned that that's not exactly true. That authority and wisdom aren't necessarily married. You can have authority and be a fool. And you can be really wise and not have a position of authority. My first student ministry was at a very small church in Southeast Kentucky. And one of my assignments, not related to youth ministry, was to visit this older lady named Beulah. I was not excited about this assignment. As a 23-year-old, I thought, I'm here to rescue all the children of this town. But I was going to go and visit. I was supposed to visit Beulah once a month and just sit with her at her home and listen to her talk. It didn't take long for me to figure out I actually had a really good gig because she would always bake when she knew I was coming. And so I got cakes and pies and just the most amazing food. And so I was like, we're visiting Beulah every week, like once a month, no way. And so I would go and sit and eat pie and listen to Beulah talk. Most of the people in our church didn't know Beulah. She had been sick for a while and she couldn't get out and go to church. And so people didn't know who she was. A lot of people just forgot about her, honestly. But she began to tell me stories about her life. She worked for the original Colonel Sanders in the original Kentucky Fried Chicken store in Corbin, Kentucky. She didn't like him very much because when she went to work for him, she brought with her a family recipe for a salad dressing. And the good Colonel used this salad dressing in his store. It became very popular, so they bottled it and sold it. And she never got any like payment or credit for the salad dressing, which was her family recipe. And I just thought that was so sad. Like, this is such a wise person who's not getting credit. Don't we see that in the story? Beulah didn't know a lot about youth ministry. She didn't have a youth ministry degree, believe it or not, or even a Bible degree. But I learned so much from her about how to do my job well, how to actually listen and care for people, not just the kids, but to think about their parents and their grandparents as well. She taught me so much. She's not the place I would have gone to for wisdom about youth ministry. That was Doug Fields at the time. There was a guy named Doug Fields. He's from a big church and he wrote a big book. And I was like, Doug Fields knows what it's all about. But actually, Beulah taught me more than Doug Fields ever did. So when she died, and I was asked to do her funeral, it was my first funeral ever, I said, yes. You would think I would be nervous, but I was actually just excited to tell people about Beulah. Like, I was like, you people have no idea how awesome this woman was that was sitting here the whole time and no one ever talked to her because you forgot about her. And she's just a wealth. I think this story is trying to push us in that direction and say, who do you go to for wisdom? Is it the people who have made a name for themselves? Or can you look around and identify that there are people who have just lived life well? They're just faithful and they have something to teach you. And you just need to go and sit and ask them questions. Listen to them talk. I think about John Knapp and Joan Hobbs. And some of you are like, I know John Knapp. Who's Joan Hobbs? You should find out. She is an absolute deep well of godly faithfulness and wisdom. And I think this is what we're being encouraged to do is like, hey, just because someone stands on a stage under a spotlight doesn't mean they know everything. I don't. And just because someone sits in a corner and quietly prays on their own doesn't mean they don't know anything. So let's think about, where are we looking for wisdom? And are we equating that with authority? And I think when we put all these things together, these ideas of injustice and joy, fate and chance versus the goodness of God, wisdom and authority, we're being challenged to shift our perspective from a worldly, temporal way of seeing life to an eternal, godly way of seeing the world and the kingdom. And it's so tempting to go, man, if everybody else would just figure this out, you know, the world would be a better place. But we are taught to look in the mirror first and say, I need to make sure that I'm not a part of bringing injustice into the world or perpetuating it through my actions. We need to make sure that I'm not falling into this camp of just chalking everything up to luck, good or bad, or fate, but I can actually be obedient to God in a way that makes a difference in the world. And I don't need to go and look for all the people who have made big names in order to find wisdom. There's probably somebody sitting next to me or behind me or in front of me right now that has wisdom for me. When we do all that together, I think we get to shift our perspective as a church family in a way that opens up good things for the people around us. Joy instead of despair. Hope instead of hopelessness. Steps forward instead of stuck or steps backward. So I have a prayer I want you to pray with me, and it's not going to be on the screen because when they're on the screen, you have to look at the screen, and I want you to be able to close your eyes. So would you go ahead and stand? I'm just going to read this prayer in short phrases and ask you to repeat them after me. So you can bow your head and close your eyes. You don't need to look up at anything. You don't even have to say anything. If this doesn't align with your heart, I'm going to read it first for you so you know if you want to read along with me on the next go around. But I just think this will help center our hearts as we get ready to sing and close. So here's the prayer I'm going to ask you to repeat in just a moment. God, show us your vision of the world as it should be, as it once was at creation, as it will be again when Christ returns. So I'm going to say this in short phrases, ask you just to repeat after me. God, show us your vision of the world as it should be, as it once was at creation, as it will be again when Christ returns. Amen. So as we close today, I just want to remind you that there is a prayer corner out here to your right. And if you need prayer for any reason, for yourself or someone that you care about, please go out there. There are people who want to pray with you. You can also just write a prayer on a card and post that for our church family to pray along with you. We invite you to do that before you leave today.